Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
Welcome back. So here's the big question. How do you make your money last as long as you do? That's a perennial question. People ask me that all the time. In fact, I think I've done over 700 second opinions on people's finances since I started my company in 1997. And that is always the question that people have. And sometimes it just requires a few adjustments to their financial plan or how they have their investments and their assets allocated. Or sometimes a new approach is required. So that's all part of getting your money to last as long as you do. But the kind of on top of that, there are a lot of mistakes that people can make unknowingly or maybe with not the best direction or maybe not the best information, and they make some mistakes that really impair their ability to have their money last or for them to be able to achieve their particular objectives, not only for their own personal income, but perhaps for future lump sum purchases or disbursements, helping family members, and then ultimately leaving money to their family, their friends, to charitable causes that they want to benefit. So let's drill down. I've got a lot of these that I want to cover. In fact, there's a total of 10 mistakes. I call it the top 10 mistakes that people make with their money. And I'm going to walk through them one at a time, and I'll get to as many as I can, but we'll come back and talk about them again on future programs. The first is probably one of the most important. And again, there's 10, so I'll leave it to you to decide which ones are most important. But number one is emotional investing or emotional decision making. I suppose investing is part of emotional decision making in general, because we make decisions that are non-financial that may be emotional. So we're going to talk specifically about the challenge of making decisions with our money when emotions get in our way. Part of it is it's very easy to get attached emotionally, to suspend logic, and to make decisions emotionally when we've had a hand in picking something or where it has a sentimental or other personal value to us. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One is the stock that you've inherited from a loved one, a family member, and that stock has sentimental value to you because it's not just the value of that stock or what it represents that you could do with that money in your own lifetime to have it provide for expenses or what you might do with it. There's also that emotional part where, you know, it was given to you by virtue of somebody dying. So that really changes the dynamics. Now, this is where getting objective advice is so important, because somebody who does not have that attachment can give you advice about the merits of keeping that particular stock in your portfolio. So you can see the obvious benefit there. Now, it's not just stocks and things like that. It's also real estate can also be another challenge. For example, my parents bought a cabin in North Carolina. They live here in Florida. In fact, they live a couple miles from my office. But they bought a cabin in North Carolina in 1994 to escape the Florida heat and humidity. So they spent, probably 20 years going back and forth and enjoying the summers there. And they really enjoyed it. They invested a lot of time and energy into fixing it up. It wasn't so much some money, although they did put money into it, but it was just the attachment they had to it. So when it became obvious to them and to me, because they asked me my opinion about it, it became obvious that it became harder and harder for them to make that trip. You know, the 10-hour drive became a lot longer and it became impractical. So they knew they needed to sell it and do something else with the money. But even though they knew that, and even though I talked to them about it and talked about their alternatives, it still was difficult. So, you know, the reality is I'm not suggesting that this is easy. I'm not suggesting that, you know, that we can, like Spock from Star Trek or the more recent iteration of that type of character, Data on the Star Trek Continues or the Next Generation, that we can somehow just turn off our emotions. We're not robots. It's very normal for people to struggle. Now, what's interesting is the fact that somebody is struggling means that they're actually aware of the emotional. you know, some people don't struggle at all and the emotions make the decisions and there's never a struggle. So the fact that it's a struggle is telling you that you know that there is an internal conflict between what is logical and appropriate and smart, all of those things, and the emotional part. Now, sometimes what happens is that people will make the decision of what they want to do emotionally first, and then they will seek, and you may have done this, I know that I've done it. Again, it's normal if you're human. You make the decision emotionally first. Then you go and find all the logical reasons to support your decision that you've already made. So whenever you feel yourself doing that and you feel that struggle, that's really the time to get somebody to look at where you are, give you a second opinion, give you some perspective that you may not had. I can't tell you how often I see this. And so if you're in that circumstance, don't be ashamed or bashful or hesitant to address it. Sometimes the hardest things to let go of aren't just the losers in your portfolio, but the winners. You know, if you've got a stock that's down in value from when you picked it, you had a hand in picking it, and you see the loss, we tell ourselves, well, it's just a paper loss, right? It's not a real loss. It'll come back. Well, people have lost the value completely of a stock or lost in a very significant way with it just quote unquote being a paper loss. Now, the flip side of that is you could have stocks or investments or mutual funds, whatever it is, or a piece of real estate, whatever the case may be, and it is a real winner. And you say, golly, look at how well this is done. I don't want to give this up. Even though that one stock or that one investment may be causing your whole portfolio to be out of whack. Second opinion, second opinion, second opinion. Somebody coming at it from a different perspective who doesn't have the history with that experience, the euphoria that's felt by seeing that stock gain and gain and gain in value, can look at it differently. They will be able to see the forest, not just the tree. Sometimes people are so close to it, they don't even know it's a tree. All they can see is bark. So it's getting removed from the decision, looking at your situation objectively. Sometimes people need help looking at what to pay off. Debt, you know, do I pay off my house? It's a complicated decision, but you stepping back from it, separating the home itself and perhaps the decisions that led to the purchase of the home, the plans you have for the home, and simply looking at that debt that you have and whether or not you should perhaps sell a stock or investments that have done well for you. Maybe you can kill two birds with one stone, sell some of the investments, pay off the debt, especially if it's a higher interest rate debt, and then go back to building your investments, or recognize that based on the interest cost that you have on your debt, that you're better off leaving it alone, continuing to pay the principal, pay the interest, and let the other money continue to work. Now, you still may need to make adjustments to the portfolio. You still may need to reallocate and rebalance. But that's where the second opinion and the objectivity is so critical. You know, it's a lot of times we can get caught up in that, but you just have to step back and ask for help. And if you do that, you'll be able to plan stronger.
Are you looking for convenient, straightforward financial information? Just say no to superficial sales presentations and yes to the free Real Money app. Get David Holland's new app for your smartphone or tablet. Just search Real Money with David Holland at your mobile device's store. You'll be able to access 17 educational TV shows, plus hundreds of radio shows and financial columns, all in the palm of your hand and on your schedule. So very easy and so very important to you. Again, to download the free app, search Real Money with David Holland.
Okay, next up is in my series about the mistakes that people make with their money, especially in planning their retirement, is another big one. Inadequate diversification. Boy, this one hurts a lot of people. You know, it's completely normal and understandable why somebody may want to go after a particular investment because they think it is a really good opportunity. And there are lots of examples of this in our history books. You know, one that really stands out is, I'm going to load up on my company stock because I work there and I know what's going on. Really? Well, hold on. Here we go. That's exactly what a lot of Enron employees did back in the 90s. They plowed everything they had into the company stock. They took all of their 401k money, put it into company stock. There are stories of even some people, employees of Enron, that took their money out of their house, got other money, told their friends, their family, load up on it. So they would say, maybe that's not the best idea. Because what we saw is that these people bet their entire financial futures, not only their jobs, their working careers, but bet their financial futures on the success of one company because they thought they were smarter than the average bear. They work for the company. I know what's going on. I can look around. I can see what's happening in this company. Really? Well, ironically, named America's most innovative company for 6 years in a row, Enron pulled off one of the greatest scams, frauds, call it what you want, cooking the books in U.S. history. And the story broke after the company reported a $600 million quarterly loss. They couldn't hide it anymore. The loss came out. They were playing a shell game, literally, with the profits and having all these different companies they quote-unquote did business with that were all fictitious. And the regulators got involved in 2001, and the stock went from, ready, $90 a share to 25 cents a share within 15 months. Wow. Okay. So 20,000 Enron employees were laid off. 20,000 people lost their jobs. They also, of course, lost all the money that was in their 401ks that had been invested in Enron stock. And they, many of them lost their houses and other money. So those thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of Enron employees, ex-Enron employees would tell you that they thought they knew what was going on because they worked for the company. And despite their intimate knowledge of what was going on at the company, they still were duped. So now let's go back to a broader scenario. How well can you know? If that happened at Enron, and I'm not going to say it's going to happen again, but do you really think that's the only time it's ever going to be that a company cheats? So if that can happen at Enron and employees that work for Enron can be duped and not see it and they're right there, do you think that could happen with other companies? Sure. Is it possible that you wouldn't know in putting a lot of money into one company that they are doing something similar or even something very innocent where they as a company aren't managing the company very well? The managers, the executives aren't doing a good job, not intentionally defrauding anybody, but just simply making bad choices. Executives make bad choices. Maybe they decided to go build a brand new facility or plant or expand into a country that all of a sudden is in civil war, or they've gone into an area where there's political instability and they've made this big bet and they get a little love note from the country's government and says, by the way, thank you for building that property or that building or that big, huge infrastructure you've spent billions of dollars on. Thank you. We're going to nationalize it. It now belongs to the state. Bye-bye. So these things can happen. This is why you don't put all your money into one stock. Don't bet everything you've got on one thing working out. You know, we've all seen I find it very amusing. You watch the poker games on television, the National Poker Championships or whatever they call. And at some moment, usually during the game, in an act of desperation, one of the players will stand up and ceremonially push all their chips into the middle of the table and go all in on one bet because they feel like they have nothing to lose. They've got to do something brazen and bold to turn the game around. Don't you do that. Okay? Don't do that. I've said before, and I'll say again, don't bet everything you've got on somebody else being right. Stay diversified. Now, the other thing I've seen is sometimes people that have retired or are approaching retirement, they're looking for one more big home run. And it doesn't just have to be stocks or mutual funds. It could be real estate. It could be a second career with a business, or the retired executive or the retired doctor or attorney or accountant or entrepreneur that had great deal of success in another line of work, takes that experience and confidence to another field and says, I can do this. I'm a sharp guy or gal. I'm going to take what I know and I'm going to translate that and now and hit one more home run. I'm going to take what I've accumulated and now go to something else and apply it and take what I've built and make it even greater. Don't do it. Or at least, if you're going to do it with a small portion of what you've accumulated. I get that people want greater financial security. You know, it's funny. I've never had a person come into my office and say, you know, David, I've got enough money, or I've got too much. It's never that. It's, and it doesn't matter how much people have. That's what's really interesting about it to me. They say, if I only had a little more. The person with $100,000 says, I wish I had $500,000. If I had $500,000, I'd have just what I need to make this work. The person with $1 million says, yeah, I've done okay. I've accumulated, but if I had an extra zero, everything would be okay. I'd feel confident. And you know, it really speaks to, and I'm not a psychologist, but it really speaks to the desire to feel like you're in a secure place. Now, I will tell you that staying away from big bets, that's one step. But also in addressing this lack of diversification, that's where planning really helps. Yes, you should get a second opinion, and you'll hear me say that all the time. But the real key is to get a financial plan where all of your money can work together. And if you've got money spread out in different places, you don't have a financial plan. You've got different little engines that are working, some that may be working better than others, but there's no cohesiveness or overall integration where these things work together toward a common goal or toward the achievement of several goals that you have. So when you look at these things, you can figure out how much is really enough. By putting a plan together, you can determine that, hey, this is enough. You've got it. You're done. You've got enough. Now, continue to work if you want to, but you've built a plan that tells you you've got enough. Do that. You'll plan stronger.
Newsflash. All financial advisors are not created equal. You need to find one who has a greater education with advanced degrees and professional certifications. One with multiple licenses offering a wide range of solutions. One who's independent and discloses his fee structure, like independent advisor David Holland. David is a CPA, certified financial planner, personal financial specialist, and chartered financial consultant. With 24 years financial experience, David offers a wide range of personalized solutions and discloses all fees in writing. Call Holland Financial for a one-on-one meeting with David at 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com.
Welcome back. All right, I'm continuing my series on the top mistakes I've seen people make with planning and investing and working toward retirement. Number three. This is a big one, and I'm going to get on my soapbox. Here I go. Inadequate advisor due diligence. There's a lot here, so let me try to get to all of it. You got to know who you're dealing with. You got to know who they are. I'm not going to kid you. Being a financial advisor carries a tremendous amount of responsibility. It takes a lot of focus. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of thought. It takes a lot of planning and thinking things through and looking at them not one, not two, not three dimensions, but looking at them in four and five dimensions, building the plan, figuring out how to put all the pieces together. There's your three dimensions, moving it forward in time, saying, what does this look like going forward? There's your fourth. And then considering alternate future realities gives me five dimensions. Yes, I know I'm a little bit of a science nut, but the point is that you really need to, I want you to recognize that financial advisors, if they do financial advising right, have a lot of responsibility, and they need to be as prepared and as educated and have as much latitude as possible to give you the best advice. So let's go through some of the issues that you could face if you don't adequately investigate them and do your due diligence before you hire them. I've got a list and I'll be referring to it. Now, a lot of this I cover in the book I wrote, How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Scams. Back in 2011, I hid at my house on 50 Fridays and I wrote two books. One of them was the first book I mentioned, How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Scams. I wrote it because it didn't exist. I've seen no book like it. It is really clear about how financial advisors work. So if you want a full discussion, get that book on some of the things I'm going to talk about right now. Number one, there are different elements to how financial advisors do business. And I call it the seven elements of how financial advisors do business. These seven pieces or components or ingredients determine how most advisors work. So here they are. Number one, licensing and regulation. Your question to an advisor before you hire them needs to be, which licenses do you have? How are you regulated? Who oversees what you do? An advisor who does not have a particular license for a particular type of financial product or security or investment cannot recommend it to you. So you need to know that, because if you're being told to do particular products or investments by an advisor and they cannot recommend other ones, you're not getting the full picture. You're not getting the full set of options that should be available. That may require you to work with multiple advisors if the advisors you work with are limited in what they can do. Now, what is ironic or interesting about that is if you have, say you have three different advisors, all that have one thing they do, but you need all three, guess who's the financial planner? You are, by default, because you're having to integrate those three things together. So, number one, licensing and regulation. How are you licensed and who regulates and oversees what you do? Number two, very related, what are your product and service capabilities? I kind of touched on that. What services and products specifically can you offer and which ones can't you? I think it's the ones that you can't that are probably more important than the ones you can, because then you'll know the things that they can't do and you may have to go somewhere else if those things might be appropriate for you. Number three, what are their industry titles and labels perhaps that they use on a business card? What title and label do they use? Some of them mean something, some of them mean nothing. So look at that very carefully when they give you their business card and ask them what it means. You know, a great example of some that, and you can see I'm already laughing a little bit. A couple of my favorites, the ones that says I'm president or CEO. Of what? They may be the only employee of their company and they're president, CEO, chairman of the board, and chief bottle washer. There's nothing wrong with that, but don't let that title give you the impression that they have a large company. Other ones I've seen, asset protection specialist. What in the world does that mean? I don't know. Something to do with protecting your assets? Consultant? Vague. What do they do? You know, I have a lot of respect for financial people that really say what they do on their business card. Financial planner, insurance agent, investment advisor. Say what you are. It's okay. Number four, this is a really big one. Degree of advisor independence. How independent are they? Do they work for a company? Who is it? How much latitude do they have in the products that they can recommend? If they work for a bank, brokerage firm, or insurance company, let's be very clear. If they are an employee of that company, the employer sets the rules, says what they can do. They can't just go and get any product that may be appropriate for you. They have a list of products that they can recommend, services they can offer by virtue of that employment relationship. It's that straightforward. Now, I'm not saying that that impairs their ability to give you good advice. I'm saying that it could, or that you need to know what that, how much latitude there is. How restrictive is it? How restrictive is that relationship? I'll give you a very simple example. If an insurance agent works for an insurance company and that insurance company pays their bills, pays for the office, pays for the receptionist, pays for an assistant, pays, whose product, whose life insurance product are they going to recommend when you go into the office to ask for life insurance? That's not a difficult question, and it's a pretty obvious answer. So you just need to understand in every scenario, how independent is the advisor? Number five, are they a fiduciary? Fiduciary is an advisor who is, for as long as the relationship exists, is required to give you the best recommendation, that which is suitable for you, and the one that they think is the best choice for you. It's a high standard. It basically works that you're at the top, they work for you, and then everybody else is below them. In other words, you're in prime pole position. They are right underneath you and working for you. Your interests come before theirs, and then everybody else is beneath the advisor in terms of their importance in the equation. It's a yes or no answer. Are you a fiduciary or not? Number six, and it's in proper order here, method of compensation. That might surprise you. That's not higher on my list here in terms of the things that are important about an advisor. I'm not so concerned about how an advisor is paid, fee-based, fee-only, commission, whatever. There are a lot of different ways that products are made available to advisors for them to recommend them to you, the consumer, their client. I'm much more concerned about disclosure of compensation or any potential conflicts. So I would, if I'm asking somebody to help me, I want to know what something's going to cost, and I want to know what they're going to be compensated. The big thing isn't how, but it's disclosure in writing. If an advisor hesitates or immediately becomes uncomfortable, like you've just sneezed all over the table, okay, and you say you've been fighting a cold and they want to get out of there as quickly as they can, I think you have your answer. I think you've identified maybe an issue that may not be best for the relationship. And last, credentials. Do they have credentials? Yes or no? Anybody who is providing advice needs to know what they're doing. Know those things about an advisor, and you can plan stronger.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.